Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by ELAC825. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860 AM, 97.5 HD2, part of the Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend talking about all the news in the world of sports. There's really just one thing we want to talk about right now, right, Jeff?
No, well, there's one thing we don't want to talk about, but I guess we have to, the elephant in the room. So the Sixers deciding that they weren't going to go out in the second round, they were going to go out in the first round.
That's
so
new.
I think the best way to do it is to talk to the guy that actually knows the Sixers best. So we got him here, Keith Pompey, Philadelphia Inquirer. How you doing?
I'm doing well. What's up, fellas? How y'all doing?
You doing better than the Sixers?
Today I am, yeah. Today I am. When they get their paychecks, they don't know a lot better than me.
Keith, it's now 23 years and counting since the Sixers last appeared in the conference finals. The process resulted in 13 first-round picks, with two still on the team, 5 second-round exits, no Eastern Conference Finals, 2 first-round exits, 3.
Hold on with all these little statistics. When they lost to the Raptors, what round was that?
That was second round. They haven't gotten past the second round.
All right.
That's the suffering. You forget the pain. People were like, "Oh, if the Sixers lose last night, it'll be bad." Last night's loss isn't even in the top 5 of the crap that's happened during the process years. So we'll get into that for a sec, but let's talk about what we saw, not just last night, but the last 2 games, because game 5 was bonkers too at MSG. So talk about it, because Jeff hasn't allowed me to invest in it, has cautioned against me investing in this, because what happened last night would inevitably happen. So talk about what we saw at the end of this series.
You know, it was weird. I mean, when you look at it, it's bad that the 76ers lost, but you have to say that all the games were exciting, right? But it came down to the end for the most part. I mean, I feel like the Sixers, I felt like they became undisciplined a little bit down the stretch for the most part in their games. And what I mean by that is it's like they forgot how to box out at certain times. They left guys open at certain times. And they allowed by that these guys to shoot the ball extremely well. Now, again, they didn't do that in the 2 games that they won, right? And it was like the other way around. But to me, it was if you're a Sixers fan, you're a little disappointed about it because you lost in the first round. But at the same time, you do have to say that it was a thrilling thing to watch. You know what I mean? I'm pretty sure like the NBA is a little upset, or ESPN is upset that they're not going to play again, but it was exciting. But at the same time, as you said, as you alluded to in the beginning, you know, the goal for the 76ers was to get out of the second round. You said that it's been 23 years, and as exciting as that game was, or that series was, they still lost 4 games. And in regards to the advancing and all this other stuff, you don't get style points for level of play. You get style points for how many rounds of the playoffs have you gone in, and they regressed. You know what I mean? Like, this was a year when Nick Nurse came out, he said that we're trying to get to the Eastern Conference Finals. That was the goal, and they couldn't get out of the first round. So this is a disappointment.
Well, I feel a whole lot better now that you've told us that it was an exciting first round.
I knew that was going to be your reaction.
I am waiting for the participation trophy that the Sixers are going to hang.
Oh, no participation trophy. You don't get a. You know why I say it was exciting first round? Because here's the thing: when the game started at 9 o'clock, or the last game started at 9 o'clock.
Jason,
please no.
So and the other game was like at 7 and goes to overtime. So people don't realize, in order for you to get stuff in the paper, you know, they got these early deadlines. You got to file right when it's over with. But when you file, you have to have a complete story. You can't just file something that's like who won, who lost, you know, stuff like
Dude,
that.
Dude, you could have filed Tobias Harris's story before the damn game started, Keith. Okay, you would have got that one wrong.
Yeah, that was a bad experience. But you know what? I kind of knew that he was going to struggle. I did.
Why? What did you see that led you to conclude that he was going to end up with?
Well, I felt like
By the way, were you at the arena yesterday?
Yeah, I was there. Yeah.
You know, you had as many points as Tobias did.
Jeff, you weren't at the arena, and you had as many points as Tobias did. And it wasn't by the way.
So I kind of figured he was going to struggle because, and here's the reason why. I felt like the last game, Joel Embiid played poorly, right? He did. You know, he did score points, but he had a lot of turnovers. It was kind of sort of like people were saying that, I don't know, I'm a little long-winded, but I just want to tell y'all, people were saying that Joel, if it wasn't for Maxey, Joel would have had another disappointing closeout game. He would have struggled. I knew right then and there that Tobias wasn't going to get a lot of touches, right? I knew that Tobias would have to go into he would have to go into Kelly Oubre mode, whereas you got to be extremely active. You got to crash the board, cuts, do all types of stuff. And Tobias tends to sit around and wait. And he tends for you to pass him the ball in certain things. And then so I just knew that Joel was going to come out guns a-blazing, so to speak, and try to do what he would do. And early on, you saw Tobias wasn't cutting. I said, uh-oh, he's going to have a bad one. But I told people beforehand that I felt like it was going to be that way. And I also told people I thought they were going to lose because it was going to get to a point where not enough people were going to get involved in the offense. And I just felt like the Knicks were hungrier and they were going to come out hungrier than the Sixers at that particular time.
You talked about it right there, hungrier. And we saw the franchise have to buy and give out tickets because the fans are exhausted from this already. It's embarrassing, not of the fans, of the franchise, that you got people who are, we talked about it with the Flyers for years, they're entering into apathy level. Your team goes into the playoffs and nobody thinks they have a shot. Jeff has told me for months, you could buy in, but they're not beating Boston. They're not advancing out. And he was right. So how do the Sixers change this?
I can't wait to clip this part of the show.
Well, look,
you know, I'm making it my ringtone.
Unlike you, I will admit when I am wrong. I was wrong when Keith was on the last time. I talked about the bench depth and Nick Nurse, and neither of those were advantages. The bench showed up in the last game, but other than that, they were dominated by the Knicks through this series. Anything that I tried to talk myself into, I was wrong.
Yeah. I think toughness is inherited, right? I mean, You just got to be a tough dude. Like, I don't think they had it. I think they had it before, and they let the guys go. I mean, it got to a point where Joel Embiid's a big guy. You know, he's the star player. But rarely do you see the star player being a guy doing the dirty shots, right? It's normally somebody else, right? Because you don't want that. You want somebody else. But he had to do it, which is a bad sign, right? I just feel like, and as far as you say, where does this team go from here? Dude, I don't know. No one does. Because the reason why I'm going to say that is, this is the seventh year that they lost in the playoffs. After the previous six, afterwards they sat down and they told us, we're going to go star hunting. Oh, well, next thing you know, we're going to go get some grimy defensive guys. Oh, guess what? We got Jimmy Butler. We got J.J. Redick. We got all these types of guys. When that didn't work, then they said, we got to get more shooters. Oh, no. We got to get a Twin Towers. We got to go out there and get, what's the guy? The guy from Boston.
Al Horford. Al Horford.
Oh, that didn't work. Oh, now we need some more things. So, dude, it just seems like after every offseason, there's always is something that they got to go get. And if you notice, it's always a cycle. You know what I mean? So they got Al Horford, but he was supposed to be the backup center, but he was going to help out. And then what happens? They got rid of him. And now all of a sudden, they need a backup center.
In fairness, now, he was a dog here. He was not what he is with the Celtics.
No, I don't think he was a dog. I think what it was is I think they didn't know. I think he was just a bad fit. Because, okay, I mean, if you look you know what I mean? Like, if you look at it, like, I mean, here's the thing. Like, this is the thing, Jason. Think about this. Before Jimmy Butler had that playoff series, one of those playoff series, people thought he was trash, too. People forget about those 1 and 3 point games. And he would say, well, what do y'all expect me to do? I'm doing my role. I'm off in the corner. I'm letting them do what they do. You know what I mean? He would say that. So I feel like when you go out and get a guy like Al Horford, Al's going to take the money because he's like, oh, they're going to pay me that much money? But at the same time, how are you going to utilize them? So when it was the bad part about that is, yes, he did look bad. But the problem was because Ben Simmons couldn't shoot, and Al Horford, because he couldn't shoot, you couldn't run him in the pick and roll or the pick and pop like you normally want to. So it was crazy. Like, at first we said him and Embiid couldn't play together. But then when Ben Simmons was hurt, they looked good. They played well together. And then when Embiid wasn't there, he looked good. So I just feel like the Sixers went out there and they keep making mistakes, man. Like, now Buddy Hill saved them last night, even though they lost. But yeah, Buddy Hill saved them.
And why didn't he play the rest of the series?
And why didn't he play in the third quarter after he had 15 points in the second quarter?
Yeah, that was a bizarre thing. And I feel like, you know, they talk about adjustments, but they didn't make adjustments. You know how it is. The plan is, I'm going to bring this guy in. He's going to give me some minutes in the first half, right? Then I'm going to take him out. But he played so well, they kept him in. But instead, they went back to the game plan and said, we're going to bring him back in the beginning of the fourth quarter. And then he's going to do it. But at that point, the guy had 17 points. I mean, he was out there looking like Steph Curry, you know. But he goes to the bench, so it was a bad display.
Yeah. Well, here's, as Jason mentioned earlier, you are bordering on apathy with this team. If they go star hunting one more time, by the way, there's not a lot of stars that are free agents. This year.
We're going to sign 34-year-old Paul George to a max contract and have the process result in a bunch of aging players that we can't watch break down.
But there's two problems now. One is Joel Embiid's about to embark on the Olympics while he's not fully healthy. And then we're going to bring him back next year, even if he is healthy. And the common denominator of all these exits is Joel Embiid. And I'm not saying they would be better without him, but I'm saying that we've never seen what Joel Embiid would look like healthy in the playoffs. Is this team ever going to be, and is he ever going to be the guy that you need for a playoff run, because he's not healthy? He doesn't, either his body can't do it or he doesn't prepare his body to do it. But that's part of your job, is preparing your body for this.
Yeah, it's true. But the only problem with this is, what are you going to get for him? I mean, you know, the Knicks came with an offer of Evan Fournier, a couple other people. I mean, like, what are you going to get? Julius Randle. Like, what are you going to get for him? You know, I mean, the thing is, he is a great player, right?
Mm-hmm.
He can't stay healthy. I give you that. But so if he's a great player and he can't stay healthy, are you going to flip one of your A-list guys for him? I mean, I'm just asking, are you? So basically, if you get him, you better hope and pray that you can get a lot of draft picks, and hope and pray that the 76ers fans are willing to go through process part two. because I don't, I, you know, like, who, I mean, if are you, okay, so he's an MVP type candidate. If you're the Minnesota Timberwolves, and not saying they don't need him because they already have who they have, right?
Right.
If you're the Minnesota Timberwolves, are you going to give up Anthony Edwards for Joel Embiid?
No.
If you're the Oklahoma City Thunder, would you give up Shea for him?
No, but I would look to maybe send draft picks to partner him with Shea and those young guys, maybe, if I'm a franchise like that.
Yeah, see that, but then that's what I'm saying.
I don't know if the Sixers want to do that.
Here's the problem with that now. They got the number one, they got the worst pick in the draft now. Or the second, right? Or one of the top ones, because they had the best record in the West. So their first round pick isn't going to be like how it was back in the day, unless they give you somebody, if they still got other
somebody
people.
Somebody else's pick.
Probably
yeah.
do. Somebody else's. So
they seem to have everybody's picks.
Yeah, they had. So what I'm just trying to say is, it's like, I don't know if you, don't get me wrong, Joel is a great player, but I don't know if if teams have what he's worth, even though he's banged up. So you're basically going to be rebuilding, and I don't know if they want to rebuild. I mean, if you put it this way, if you take Joel Embiid off that team, they were a lottery team, right?
Yeah,
right.
They were a lottery team. They mm-hmm. were like the Spurs, the Washington Wizards. I mean, think about it. They were struggling to beat these teams when Joel wasn't there, right? So to me, it's kind of like, I don't think the people in Philly want to go through that, especially if they're trying to buy a new arena.
Well, and
they're not getting a new arena.
And you can't, you look, you right now, you got Joel Embiid and you got people, you got people giving the tickets to Knicks fans.
I was going to say, how many other tickets are they going to have to buy at the new arena? Like, if they don't solve the fundamental problem that this team doesn't win, it won't matter how many stadiums they built. It just won't matter. They'll win the headline. They'll get a flashy piece of glass in the city, and they'll lose. And eventually, they'll lose money and sell because the attendance will go down. You don't lose money with an NBA team, but they won't make as much money, and that's really all they care about. Look, Josh Harris wasn't here for the playoff game. He was at the draft. All right? We know that his attention is split now between three franchises. And under his watch, we've had three general managers. I get that the NBA stepped in and made one of them happen. The other one had a burner. I get it. The storylines are crazy.
Well, he did hire them.
He did. We've had three head coaches. We've had stars. We've had picks. And you say trade them for picks. We've drafted. We were going to go look for shooters. Isaiah Joe's shooting someplace. Mikal Bridges is shooting someplace. Like, we had guys who we drafted that we either didn't let shoot or didn't step on the damn court to shoot in the first place. So
even Haywood Highsmith is making a name for himself in Miami.
That's what
Haywood Highsmith. So, how many times did we interview that guy when he was with the Bluecoats?
So it's like, I don't have faith in the organizational structure at this point. So I get that Daryl Morey might have $60 million suspended, max slots. If he spends it on Paul George, who comes in and has an ailing knee with Joel Embiid's ailing knee, and it's Tyrese Maxey and a bunch of scrubs because they can't afford a bench, what are we even doing here?
Yes, that's the big question, man. You're not doing the daggone thing. Because the funny part is, when you look at it, we can say all we want, right? You know who the number one free agent is? And he's a restricted free agent. But who's the number one free agent this summer?
Tyrese Maxey.
Tobias Harris.
Yep.
Tyrese Maxey.
No, Tyrese Maxey.
Right.
A restricted free agent is the number one free agent this summer. So it's kind of like you said, there's not a lot out there. Like OG, you know, people are going to bring his name up. Like if New York is allowing him to give him some freedom that Nick Nurse never gave him, you think he's going to leave that? Especially with the excitement that's going on in New York right now in that market, he's not leaving. And then you look at Pascal Siakam. You know what I mean? Look, they just beat the Bucks, right? He's a vital part of that. And do you think he wants to come here and be in Joel Embiid's shadow? Nah. Like, so those are two guys that's coming off. The thing about Paul George, you know, Paul George is like, yeah, I mean, you think you want to come here, but do you really want to come here? Especially after you have a conversation with James Harden and he's telling you stuff. So then you look at LeBron James like, oh, well, okay. Well, we'll get LeBron James, but LeBron's about to be 40. Now, I do like it. It sounds good, right? He could be a third guy. It sounds all this and that. But, you know, is that the guy you're going to give all your money to?
You're also going to get Bronny James.
Yeah, you're going to get Bronny. Bronny's going to be the two guard. And Melton's out of the picture.
I hate everything about this conversation right now, Keith. This is like the kind of stuff that, and these are legitimate conversations right now going on, but these are the kind of things that like fantasy drafters do that Jeff would kill me for even talking about. And yet these are the legitimate options for the best freedom we've ever had.
Yeah. I mean, but you know what, man, is the legitimate option, but the scary part about these options, they all said that they were options years ago when they won Star Hunting, before they went out there and got Jimmy Butler. Think about it. Jimmy Butler great player. But Jimmy Butler was like a B-list type of guy, all-star. Like, they won after Paul George. They won after Kawhi. They won after LeBron. They couldn't get any of them. So they said, let's trade for Jimmy, right? Let's trade for Jimmy. And Jimmy was great. You know, he was an all-star, but he hadn't ascended into the Jimmy Butler that's leading Miami to two championships.
Well, and he had a reputation of being a difficult teammate at the time.
Yeah, so. He had a reputation of being a difficult teammate at the time, right?
We know so, you got a run so on this, us, too.
So the thing is, it's kind of like, you know, you say you want something, but at the same time, it's kind of like a wait and see. I mean, for now, what we know is they can't get out of the second round. They couldn't get out of the first round. You know, Nick Nurse was supposed to be the answer. He may be the answer next year, but he wasn't this year. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, the thing is, you know, if Brett Brown would have not put Buddy Hield in the game in the third quarter, he would have been vilified. If Doc Rivers would have done that, it would have been memes out there with him. You know, rap songs about saying how bad of a coach he is. You know what I mean? So the crazy thing with this franchise, it's the same thing keeps happening over and over again. It's just different names on the back of the jersey and different coaches. Joel Embiid gets injured annually, right? There's always a coaching decision that we're questioning, right? Lack of adjustment. And it just seems like the team just tends to be soft. And then when they're tough, you don't have no shooters. So that's the problem. Like, there's been questionable trades, especially recently. Like, there's been guys like Kyle Lowry didn't score a point. I think that he's a good point guard, but I think he's a point guard. He's not a two guard. Like, they got him off the ball, right? So him and Tobias didn't score. Buddy Hield, he had one good game. It was a good game, but he had one good game. Think about the trades that they made in the past. The same thing. They were bringing these guys in. And remember George Hill? Remember George Hill? Everybody thought he was going to be
there. Don't go there. Don't go.
Yeah, I'm just saying. I'm just saying, though. It was a lot of that, dude.
Well, here's the deal. You have the unfortunate task now of going to a very unhappy building and seeing what's going on there. I just get to deal with Jason for the rest of the show.
Yeah, he's going to have an unhappy Jason. We'll read about it all at Pompey on Sixers in the Inquirer. Keith Pompey, thanks for giving us a first-hand account of it all, and we'll talk to you in the offseason, man.
Yeah, let's go Giants for my man, son. I'm wishing him well, you know what I mean?
I'll let you get a go Giants on that one.
The Eagles were in the building. The Eagles were in the building last night.
Yeah.
That worked out well.
They should have had Saquon ring the bell. Have a good one, Keith.
So is Bradley Cooper.
Deuces.
See you later.
All right, now you're just stuck with me to talk. We've got Keith gone. Any other thoughts we didn't get to him on what we saw or where this team is right now?
You need tickets for the next game?
Why, are the Sixers trying to sell them to you?
I'm sure. You know what? I don't understand what they thought they were doing by saying that they were buying the 2,000 tickets. I know they think that because it was, what, the first responders, they thought they were doing something great. That's wonderful. But take a step back for one second and ask yourself, where did they get 2,000 tickets? And there's only two possible explanations for it. One, nobody gave a bleep, and so they had 2,000 extra tickets for a game six deciding game, as far as in our building, for a playoff game, or they were holding them back because they were going to stick them on the secondary market and profit more than if they sold them themselves. Either way, it should make your skin crawl about what's going on with the Sixers.
You got to the point where I couldn't even text you about this team last week.
No, this is, and I am a kid who grew up on the Sixers. You knew that, you know, I don't get super excited when we interview athletes any more than interviewing anybody else, but Dr. J was my idol.
Yeah, you were kind of giddy when we got to talk to him.
Yeah, it was an honor. But what has gone on with this team? And I'm obviously not the only person. If they had 2,000 extra tickets to a playoff game, is I got to the point that I didn't even want to watch it anymore. And it's, I'll watch lots of games where my teams aren't going to win or going to suck. But when you've seen this over and over and over, and I can keep saying over for as much time as we have left on the show, but it's the same story. This is Groundhog Day for basketball.
I tried to talk myself into it. Should be ashamed. I tried to talk myself into it. I wanted to believe. And then I realized that we've all watched it go from Michael Carter Williams to Markelle Fultz, to the Al Horfords, James Hardens. We've had guys quit on this team. We've had, like, the stories are just
And then by the way, and then you look at a team like Oklahoma City that kind of did the same thing the Sixers did, but somehow got it right.
Look, this, I mentioned it to Keith. The Sixers had 13 first-round picks in this time. As of next year, two of them will be on this team.
Embiid and Maxey.
That's all they have to show for the process. After all of that losing and tanking and decision-making and trades and star hunting and headlines and frustrations, and it just, it's maddening as a fan. And I wanted to buy in. I did, and you kept saying to me,
I know you did, but some of us said, you know what, it's better going to sleep.
Can I just bitch a little bit more, because I'm good at that?
About the 9 o'clock time?
Come on, man. Like, I get it.
If you were me, it wouldn't have made a difference.
Well, no, you're not staying up anyway. But right. I got a 7-year-old.
Not for that.
I got a 7-year-old who's really getting into basketball and wants to watch it.
They don't care.
Even if he wants to stay awake, he can't make the first quarter. You have adults that are falling asleep at halftime. I know they don't care. They should, though.
Well, they don't.
Because the advertisers need to sell to the same people that are falling asleep. That's why they should care. The TV stations need those people to watch. It's embarrassing the way that they scheduled this, that you had a game start on the East Coast at 9 o'clock, actually played on the East Coast. Like, if you're starting out on the West Coast.
All right. Are we going to go to 11 o'clock or 11:30 on this?
All right. Why don't we take a break?
You do this all the time.
Because
I feel for you, but I know they don't care.
Because that I am a dad who's trying to get his kids into sports and whose kids are coming to me saying they want
Your kid will watch on replay. Your kid will watch highlights. The fact that he can't watch live, they don't care about that.
I do, though.
You'll still watch the highlights. You'll still buy the products. You'll still.
But we're the heart of sports, and I don't get the experience of watching with him. And you had that experience with your son, and I resent
the
fact.
Well, that's because I stayed up late.
I resent the fact that sports won't give me that now because they've sold out to TV, and I'm the ratings guy.
I had the same problem. He just stayed up late.
You just trained your kid to have a later.
You're gonna have to let him stay up late. The world did not change in the last 10 years. It was the same thing. So have him stay up late, deal with the consequences when his homework's done, and hope that someday he graduates. That's all you can do.
Why don't we go to break? We'll talk some trash talk, and then we'll close out with a little bit more. Stick with us.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.
Jeff, you and I have fun talking to each other, a little trash talk. We got somebody on who actually knows about trash talk more than me and you. Author of the book Trash Talk, the only book about destroying your rivals that isn't total garbage, Rafi Cohen. Rafi, congrats on the book. Thanks so much for giving us some time to talk about it.
I appreciate that. I appreciate y'all having me on, too. Love talking trash with you.
It seems like everybody loves talking trash, but you kind of go back to the start with this book. There's nothing new about this. You go back to the early times in ancient Rome and Greece. Talk about how trash talk draws us in using words as gamesmanship instead of violence.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Trash talk is all around us, right? You know, it's It's the stuff that brings us into like, marketing campaigns and of, or self-promotional boxers or, rap beefs or, or reality television or, talking head pundits screaming at one another on sports debate shows or any other kind of debate shows. And, people would be excused for thinking that this is something new because trash talk as a term has actually only been around for about 40 years, a little bit more than 40 years, and really only in sort of like the popular vernacular for the last 30 or so. But really, it's just a new name for like, a deeply ingrained ancient human behavior of competition, right? You can find trash talk all the way back in the Bible and the Homeric poems, and you can trace it, throughout history and across cultures, across geography. And there is something really sort of like fundamentally human about talking trash, right? There's something in our competitive spirit and kind of in, in the way we interact with one another socially that just lends itself to this kind of, verbal bravado or one-upsmanship or put-downs, which are really just two sides of the same coin. And the thing, to answer your question, because that was a lot of lead up, the thing that draws us in is that at the most fundamental level, when you talk trash to someone, you are raising the stakes of competition. You are upping the ante of what's taking place between me and you or anyone else or whatever the sort of broader context of that competition might be. I'm suggesting that you don't have what it takes to succeed, or you're suggesting that I don't have what it takes to succeed. Like, regardless of what I actually say, that's the implication. And when you do that, suddenly there's more on the line. You're talking about pride, you're talking about sense of identity, you're talking about sense of belonging. And, I mean, you can even think about it. Let's say, Jason, you and Jeff, start talking trash to each other, and and Jeff says, "Jason, you're a noodle-armed weakling. Let's arm wrestle and see who can take the other one." Without that, nobody cares about watching you two arm wrestle. But once
How
you
does he
start
know you so well, Jason?
We prep before the show. Don't worry. I made sure that he knew that.
See, if I were Jason, when you were talking about David versus Goliath and ancient times, if I were Jason, I would have said, "Jeff, do you remember that?" But see, he totally missed it.
I'm just not prepared for these opportunities.
But that's it. Once you start talking like that, now it matters, right? Like, without the trash talk in arm wrestling competition or whatever, who cares? But once you start talking trash, now there's something on the line, and that's what draws us in.
So look, it dates back to ancient times, but as far as the OG, the person that made it popular in our culture, can you go back farther than Muhammad Ali, or is Muhammad Ali really the beginning of it being part of our society?
I mean, when you frame it that way, the answer is no, you can't really go back beyond him. Because of course you can go back further than him in terms of trash talk as like a competitive practice, right? For all the reasons we already discussed, seeing David, talking trash in the Bible, and certainly folks even in the US before Muhammad Ali, whether you're talking about, Sugar Ray Robinson or Jack Johnson, or going back to the bench jockeying days of baseball. This is all trash talk. It's just trash talk by a different name. But when we talk about the sort of modern popular conception of what it means to talk trash, Muhammad Ali is the godfather. He is the OG because he's the one that brought this kind of, modern understanding of what it means to talk trash, which is influenced by this, by like, Black oral traditions like toasting, like playing games like the dozens, which sort of, put a new spin, put a new flavor on trash talk. He brought that, to the, to the public, to a wide public audience in a way that it had never had, that it had never been done before. And he got a platform that no one had ever had before. And he used it in a way that no one had ever used it before, right? From the idea of, hyping himself up, promoting boxing matches, trying to get inside the heads, of his opponents, self-motivating himself too by raising the stakes on himself. Like, he used trash talk in almost every possible, functionality, and he put it on public display. And he had imitators following him in baseball, in basketball, you know, in the music world and beyond, and those, and that's just where everything spreads. So it really does, when we talk about like what we think about trash talk now, it all goes back to Muhammad Ali.
There are different types of trash talk too that you examine from the science of it, the anxiety and stress side pushing somebody to the threat state. I'm more interested in the attention and focus to the attentional state where you kind of get them off their game by making them focus on it. There was a Gilbert Arenas said you should talk trash to Russell Westbrook because he becomes a Ferrari or a Lamborghini in traffic. Can you talk about the attention and focus side of getting in people's head?
So, yeah, that, I mean, and the title of that chapter is The Most Critical Dimension. And that's talking about attention, because attention is sort of the fulcrum at which all of these other sort of like psychological, you know, elements, you know, the, you know, that explain the ways in which trash talk can affect performance. They all come together, you know, at the point of attention, you know, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One, on the most basic level, is that we have a limited capacity for attention, right? We have a limited budget. And when someone is competing at their best, they're going to be completely immersed in those things and only those things that relate to their task at hand, right? That relate to the performance of what they're doing. And so if you
can... Jason, can you understand, can you hear, can you remember what we're talking about?
Yeah, I'm good. I gotcha.
It's taking notes.
I'm keeping track. I'll be using all of these tips and tricks for the next couple of weeks on the show.
Short attention span.
Yeah.
He's trying to throw you off your game and mine too, man.
That's what he does. That's what
he does. Yeah, I love it. You know, but then that's the thing is that, so it's like what you want to be as a trash talker is you want to be attention grabbing, right? You want to steal someone's attention. You want to introduce task irrelevant cues, right? Something that's going to distract them from what they're doing. And what's really fun about this is that there's so many different ways to do it, right? Because we talk about, you know, introducing threat and potentially pushing someone into a threat state. Threat is a great way to also simply steal someone's attention, even if they're not going to be necessarily overwhelmed by anxiety and enter into a fight, flight, or freeze mode, right? If you're still doing something that someone could interpret as threatening in one form or another, you're probably going to get their attention for a moment. But even more than that is just doing something unexpected, which is sort of where like I really just kind of geek out on this, because you can just get weird at this point, right? You know, this is where you're talking about, you know, the people who can just act bizarre in one form or another. You think about the people, you know, who might even be polite to one another over the course of competition, which is like the antithesis of what we think of as trash talk. But, you know, Andrew Luck, when he got sacked, he would jump up, slap the defensive lineman on the ass and say, "Hey man, great job. You really got me. That was a great hit." And it was just like, this was so, you know, counter, you know, to the expectation of this, you know, high intensity, you know, competitive environment, that you could kind of knock the guy off his game just by stealing his attention in that way. And really, you don't even necessarily have to like get someone to be, you know, so distracted that they forget what they're doing entirely. It's even small shifts in attention can have huge implications in terms of, you know, competitive outcomes. Because like, you can think about someone, you know, who's you mentioned the example of Westbrook. What does that mean exactly to be a Ferrari in traffic, right? It's like, that means suddenly now I'm letting ego and pride take over, right? I'm responding to what you're saying to me. And now I'm focusing on a sort of creating a sort of one-on-one competition, going head to head with you. And as a result of that, I might miss some of the cues that are happening around me. Like the fact that, you know, the guy on the wing is cutting to the basket and there's just that small opening where I could I lace a pass in there and he could get a layup. But if I'm not open to all that, if I'm focused too narrowly on one thing, I might miss that. And that could be the difference between not just making or missing a basket, but winning or losing a game.
You know, you talk a lot in the book about basketball. We all know about Larry Bird. You tell stories about John Starks and Reggie Miller. What is it about basketball that lends itself to trash talk more than any other sport?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I was actually just thinking about that earlier today, because I was just sort of thinking about all the various people I talked to. And it's like, there's so many basketball people here. And there is a reason for it, I think. And I think, well, for one, there's a lot of face-to-face interaction, right? And it's pretty, so you have the opportunity to talk to your opponents, you know, on the regular, whereas even in soccer, which is like a nonstop game like basketball, you kind of have all this space. There's so much space. So you don't have necessarily the proximity, to do that kind of trash talk. But also, you don't have the luxury of time in basketball either to kind of reset and refocus if you are thrown off your game, right? If you're a golfer and you hit a terrible shot, you've got the entire walk up the fairway to beat yourself up, kick yourself in the butt, until you get back up and pick out your club, and then you just need to focus again for 6 seconds, then you can start, self-flagellating again. But in basketball, like even a second of that, and that's a turnover, that's a foul, that's a missed opportunity. You let someone drive by you. So I think it's more of a pressure cooker in that sense, right? That it's like all this stuff is put to the test almost constantly and without respite, unless you get subbed out of the game. So I think for all those reasons, basketball is sort of like the perfect proving ground, the petri dish for all this kind of stuff.
And you have lots of examples of basketball. You make the case that to be a good trash talker, you need to know how trash talk actually works. Zach Randolph lulling people to sleep with his trash talk. Cheryl Miller saying the best way to screw up someone's shot is to tell them how well they're shooting at that moment. Michael Jordan, talk about some of your favorite stories from the book of trash talk.
Yeah. I mean, those are good ones. And it's that idea of attention again, that if you can kind of with Cheryl Miller in particular, right? You're trying to get someone internal. You're trying to make someone think about the things that they shouldn't be thinking about. The psychologists call it reinvestment. You're dedicating, cognitive energy to things that should be automatic, right? Like your putt, like your shooting form. And when you start thinking about the things you're supposed to do instead of doing them, you screw it up. My personal favorites were kind of the ones that were like, I mean, it's easy to say Gary Payton, it's easy to say Reggie Miller, it's easy to say Muhammad Ali, and there's incredible stories along those lines. In fact, some of my favorite stories from the book involve Gary Payton for sure. But the guy that I loved talking to more than anyone else and was most sort of like surprising to me, as a trash talker, was Shep Messing. And he was a former goalkeeper for the U.S. men's soccer team. He was in the 1972 Olympics, and then he competed in the NASL, with the New York Cosmos alongside guys like Pele. And what made
And
him.
yes, Jason, I'm old enough and went to a game where Shep Messing was the goalie and Pele was
I
on the
believe
team.
Okay, so Rafi, it is do you have to trash talk when you're already so in somebody's head that they trash talk themselves? Isn't that the ultimate form of trash talk that I'm doing? I don't even have to say it, and Jeff jumps in because he knows where my head goes already.
You really, that you're gonna take credit for this?
You're damn
Good luck
right.
with that. Okay.
Absolutely, man. It's requiring no effort on your part, and you start trash talking yourself. Although I would say that there is value also in sort of acknowledging and owning your own, perceived weaknesses and
Oh,
vulnerabilities,
I
right?
do that. Believe me, Jeff has seen me try to dribble between my legs as we tried out for a G League team. I own every weakness and flaw that I have live on this radio show weekly.
Well, you own
it's
it,
pretty
right?
weak to call it a tryout, but go ahead. Let's get back to Shep Messing.
But it can't, but then you don't let it bother you, right? Because it's like, this was a, for a little while I was considering, as part of my reporting for this book, if I should like try to like create some kind of like wrestling character, in order to like, to learning how to cut a promo and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, well, what kind of wrestling character would I be? And I was like, well, it has to be just like a self-deprecating Northeastern Jew. Like, I don't know what kind of like, because that's like the most authentic, true to self, character I could come up with. And the idea is you insult yourself so much that nobody else can insult you. So you kind of become impervious to it. But Shep, what made Shep so devious was that, this guy studied psychology as an undergrad, right? This guy wasn't just thinking, like, how can I get in someone's head, but how can I get in someone, like, each individual's head in the most, like, personally, personalized, tailored way possible that they're going to not going to be able to ignore it. And so he would do things like do research on different nationalities to say, like, well, what's going to be most upsetting to like an Italian guy versus a German guy versus a guy, versus a Mexican guy? What's the thing that's be and he would literally go to his teammates in the locker room and be like, what can I say that will mess this guy up? And they all thought it was hilarious. Then he would just try to play mental games with guys too. His whole thing was he knew that as a goalkeeper, There's this aura around goalkeepers in soccer that you have to be a little bit crazy to play the position in the first place. And so he would embrace that. He would walk around sort of like in a daze, sort of mumbling to himself, and he would grab then on corner kicks, and then he would grab an opposing player, you know, by the lapels, you know, if jerseys had lapels, and say like, "I'm so sorry if I do anything, you know, if I do anything crazy, I'm off my medication," you know, just make them a little bit wary of what he was doing. I mean, he actually got even a little bit more devious than that. But the point is, he was always thinking, how can I stay one step ahead of these guys? How can I get inside their heads? And not just in a, like, I'm trying to put you down kind of way, but in a way that you're not going to see coming and that therefore you're not going to be able to prepare for either.
All right. So tell me about how psychological profiles can be leveraged against athletes through trash talk, because that's the real science of this. I mean, I'm waiting for, we have analytics in baseball. This seems like where they're going to go in sports. How can you get somebody off their game seems like a key thing to disrupting their skill set.
Couldn't agree with you more. And this is an idea or a question that I had sort of guiding my reporting at various points. I don't necessarily like posit this as like, I'm not suggesting in the book that somebody hire me for, you know, to be their like analytics of trash talk department, but it's all in there. And it's like, and that, to your point that like, you want to be a good trash talker, you want to know how it works. You got to know how this stuff works from like a, you know, performance psychology level. And I actually asked this question to Shane Battier when he was still the, I forget his exact title, whatever, executive vice president of like player developments and analytics for the Miami Heat, whatever it was. But he's always been like a sabermetrics analytics kind of guy. And so I asked him, like, how do you apply this stuff to exactly this? Because it seems like very clear, just like you said, that there's a way to do this and there's a time to do it. And there's a way to sort of, you know, create efficiencies around this that might not otherwise exist. Who to go after, who not to go after, when to go after them. And he was very coy in his response. he said, it doesn't. He's like, no, that we don't, we're not doing that. It's like, have you thought about it? He's like, and he said, I've thought about it. I haven't given up on it either. I'm like, will you tell me about it? He said, no, I will not, because I'm still keeping that in my back pocket. So I don't know where he's going with it exactly. But to me, the applications are clear, right? You understand, like, one, what makes someone vulnerable? Things like, you know, insecurities, vulnerabilities. Who feels like maybe, you know, that they've got something that they have to lose, right? Is it a roster spot? Are they on a, you know, are they slumping? Are they in their own head for one reason or another? You know, what stands out about a person? What, you know, what is someone's sort of like peak performance state in terms of like, you know, high or low stress levels? You know, someone like Russell Westbrook or Draymond Green, they love to be super high worked up, right? But can you get them even higher than where they want to be? Or on the flip side, can you get them low? Can you compliment them? Can you tell them, hey, man, it was so great to see you last week, you know, in out in San Francisco, with, you know, it's just such a pleasure to be on the same court with you. Can you get them to downregulate? Can you get them to sort of lower their levels? And to your point, are there specific times when people would be more vulnerable than at other times, right? Like when you're more tired, are you maybe going to have a harder time refocusing from a distraction toward the thing you're supposed to be, you know, paying attention to? You know, after you've missed three shots in a row, are you going to maybe be more vulnerable to the insinuation that you don't have it tonight? Or maybe you should be thinking about, you know, about your form, about your shooting form, and thinking about the mechanics of it. So I think there are things that are very clearly applicable that front offices could be doing. And actually, the English and the England and Wales Cricket Board, which is basically the organizing body for the like the British cricket team, they have psychological profiles of their players. And they, you know, in terms of like who's, you know, sort of risk averse, who's sort of, you know, punishment sensitive, reward sensitive, all these kinds of things. What are their sort of, you know, their sort of state and trait, you know, anxiety levels, where do they perform at their best? And they use this, of course, not to try to, you know, destroy their players, but to kind of guide them to where they need to be at their best. But you could absolutely do the same kind of profiling on someone and say, how can we turn this against that person? I mean,
are there athletes that you came across that actually do research? Like, who's the best at doing research before he goes and talks trash?
So from a research perspective, you know, you can go back to the very early days to guys like John McGraw in baseball, who would literally hire, you know, private detectives to dig up dirt on his opponents and, you know, deeply personal things that, you know, they wouldn't expect to hear because, again, that's attention grabbing, right? John Randall in the NFL. You remember, even Jason's maybe old enough to remember that one.
There we go.
You know, that, you know, he would pore over, you know, the media profiles, the press clippings, any magazine profiles. He would want to know who had surgery in the offseason, who had a DUI, you know, who got a divorce, all this kind of stuff. But actually, if we're going to think about, if I'm going to tell you who was the absolute best at doing research, the answer may surprise you because it's not a player. And it's Robin Ficker. Robin Ficker is an all-time legendary heckler who used to sit behind the Washington Bullets and Washington Wizards bench. And he was a lawyer, trial lawyer. And he learned, you know, he honed his skills, you know, doing research at the Library of Congress at the foot of his dad who worked there, you know, took those skills with him through law school and then started applying those exact same skills of research, you know, to opposing players when they were coming in to play against the Bullets and then Wizards, you know, and he would find out like who's behind on their, you know, child support, you know, who is, you know, who got a new car and I'm going to threaten to key their vehicle, who hates eating vegetables, Charles Barkley.
Well, that seems like a whole lot more work than Tracy Morgan's response to Tyrese Maxey getting a shot against
just giving the finger the other night.
Well, yeah, you know, tonight's not
What's
a good
for trash talk.
Today's not a good day for me to talk trash as a Knicks fan. But
we both had a collapse late in the game or an emergence in this series. It's been a crazy series to watch.
It has been, and I can tell you, it's been like some of the most rewarding experiences as a fan, like almost like full circle moments.
I don't find it that at all. I find I'm hating myself for watching at this point, and texting Jeff how much I hate myself for watching this.
You got to embrace it, man, because like the pain is part of the pleasure, and it's, you know, I went as a Yankee fan, having watched all of the 2004 ALCS, I will never get those 20 hours back of game 4 through 7. And I hate myself for that. But you know, Reggie Miller scoring 8 points in 9 seconds against the Knicks on my 12th birthday, like literally on my 12th birthday. Like, that's a pain that is also like, you know, it's fortifying in some ways because it reminds me that I care as a fan.
Ask right? Jeff how many times I've talked about Joe Carter's home run against the Phillies in the World Series on this show and how much that has shaped my fandom in life.
Yeah, but that's a good thing. I've spent the last 25 years or, you know, 20 years as a Knicks fan having nothing to care about, not feeling pleasure or pain. When Trae Young beat the Knicks in the, you know, in the playoffs a couple years ago, and he was pulling his Reggie Miller and bowing at half court, I was like, man, I hate you, but I love that I hate you because I have a reason to hate again. And it's like, that's, so I'm still in my honeymoon.
All right. The book is Trash Talk, the only book about destroying your rivals that isn't total garbage. Rafi, thanks so much for giving us some time to talk about it all, man.
It was a lot of fun, guys. Thank you for having me.
It did not make me feel any better that we closed that segment with him trash talking about the Knicks after how that series has gone. But I thought that was an interesting interview, both the things that are said and the things that are unsaid and getting in people's heads.
Yeah, well, you know what? I want to talk about a guy who trash talks, but it's not the kind that you just sit there and say is a good thing. So look, never been a fan of Deion Sanders. I now have to watch him because I have somebody that goes there. I'm disgusted by him. I didn't like him before, but I'm disgusted by him. He is going to single-handedly ruin the sport more than everybody else has. He appears not to recruit kids out of high school. He's using completely the transfer portal. And now this story came out, I don't know if you saw it in The Athletic, where players were saying that he's demeaning, that he doesn't treat people well, that he breaks them down. And his answer and his son's answer was to trash this kid. And to trash talk him in social media, and for him to think that he's the only one that can use the bully pulpit. And at some point, somebody's got to stand up and say, you know what, Deion, it's a bridge too far. At some point, you just have to shut up. You've accomplished nothing. You got your team from 1 win to 4 wins. You left a program, an HBCU program that you built, and destroyed it, single-handedly destroyed it, and took every good player. And then you came somewhere else, and your ego tells you that you're something great because you won three extra games.
Well, wasn't
you
he
were
the
4-8 last
year? Wasn't he
year.
The same thing as a player, though? I mean, what? Wasn't he the leading edge of the type of player now that is more focused? Like, he seems to be coaching and acting the same way he did when he played.
Selfish.
That
selfish, egocentric. That's what he is now. And you watch what, because he has spent all of this collateral going through the transfer portal to sell his soul for now so that Shador can be the number one pick. That's it. You watch. There's no building of a future. There's no recruiting of high school kids so that you're prepared for 2025 and 2026 and beyond. He has taken a program that was desperate for something.
So did Colorado make a deal?
Desperation for himself.
Did Colorado make a deal with the devil?
Yes, they did. And it will have gotten them nothing except some publicity for 2 years.
Will they have better facilities and stuff? Will they have gotten more money out of it, or is it just transactional?
This will all have been a short-term gain that will end up in long-term disaster.
It doesn't say anything to the complaint of the player if you're attacking them. Doesn't that kind of back up what they're saying, that you're kind of trying to break
them
down?
That he tears them down?
Then you're going in public and tearing them down. Isn't that kind of validating what the player is saying that they did?
Yeah. I mean, look, did the transfer portal make this situation worse and create monsters as far as coaches who think they need to do it this way? Sure it did, but there are still coaches that are trying to do it right. There's still coaches that have class, dignity, and treat young adults with the same respect that they deserve and that they would want themselves. I don't believe Deion Sanders is that person.
Well, we have 1 minute left. Can I be excited that the Phillies are 21-11?
Yes. Okay? In April.
Yes.
In April. Usually you watch the Phillies and the first couple of months is they can't hit the ball out of the infield because for some reason they can't hit in the cold. They're 21-11. They have the best starting rotation in baseball.
They're first in innings pitched, 180 and a third for their starter.
Well, that should worry you.
So, well, yeah, it does. And then Zach Wheeler clearly doesn't like an extra day rest. So I don't know what they're going to do with Turnbull and Taiwan Walker, but it's not going to be a 6-day rotation because Wheeler made that clear.
No, but he's going to need it.
He
Zach
is.
Wheeler's going to need it. He's going to need to be smart with his body.
He is. Any final thoughts before we sign off for this week?
It's going to be another good week for the Phillies, and it's not going to be for the Sixers.
Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.